The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. If you were lucky enough to have access to healthcare, do you think about those that don't? Without health insurance, where would you go? How would you get help in the event you needed medical attention? My guest today, Rachel Pearson, is a doctor and writer who has thought a great deal about access to care and the medical profession's role in addressing historical injustice based on race, class, or gender. She's written a memoir of her medical education called No Apparent Distress, which is medical code speak for a patient who appears to be okay. That is certainly not her diagnosis of the American healthcare system. From her pre-medical days working as an advocate in an abortion clinic to her time at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston post-Hurricane Ike, Pearson takes us on a journey through different sectors of medicine with an eye toward humanism, art, and soul rather than the big business American medicine has become. Pearson is a resident in pediatrics at Seattle Children's Hospital, and the inspiration for her memoir came from her humanities and journalism backgrounds. When an article she wrote for Texas Monthly magazine about changes at UTMB attracted significant attention. Dr. Rachel Pearson, author of the new memoir, No Apparent Distress, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Rachel Pearson, welcome to Medical Monday. You did not have what we might call a conventional path to a career in medicine, did you? You write about having spent some time doing construction with your father. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm from a really small town in Texas. My dad is a carpenter, and I worked for him during the summers in college, and my brother worked for him quite a bit. This sounds strange, but it was working for my dad doing construction work that gave me a taste for work that felt concrete, where I could do something with my hands and see the effects of my work in the world. And medicine felt like a way to do work that was similar to my dad's, but that also followed some of my own specific interests.
And you made the leap in a way to go to medicine, kind of put your toe in the water. One of the things that you did was you worked as a patient advocate at an abortion clinic, and you had some pretty profound experiences. Can you share some of those with us?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny, I sort of fell into that job. I actually needed money because I was moving to New York. So I got this job as a patient advocate while I was finishing my last year of college, getting ready to go to New York. And I loved it. I had no prior experience in medicine, but I trained in different areas of the clinic. And my very favorite was working as a counselor. So Texas has a law that women have to have mandatory counseling before having an abortion. And at that clinic, we tried to use that time, that counseling time, for good, to give women a chance to talk about whatever they needed to talk about. And I found that for my Spanish-speaking patients in particular, that space where it was confidential, where the person that they were talking to, the counselor, myself, or one of my colleagues, was only there to listen to them and support them. That space allowed these stories that could not be told anywhere else to come to the surface. And it was a huge privilege to be able to hear those stories. And it wasn't what I expected. For example, in the book, I talk about this patient who was, you know, a very devout Catholic who was in really dire economic straits, and she had kids, and she had gotten pregnant, and she was sure that if she had this baby, she wouldn't be able to feed the kids that she already had. She was so stretched. And so as a Catholic, and as the particular kind of Catholic that she was, she felt that if she had an abortion, she would probably go to hell. And she was committed enough to being able to take care of her living children that she was willing to go to hell in order to be able to feed them. And so that surprised me. And that was the kind of story that, I don't know, it just really changed my life and made me feel like I needed to be in that space, that medical space where those stories could be heard. And it was really that job in part two that pushed me towards medicine.
And you mentioned that you were trying to earn money to go to New York. Were you enrolled in a writing program? Tell us about the decision to go into a writing program and then ultimately, I think, to leave the writing program.
Yeah, so I guess I still am a writer.
I would say you are now, yes.
But at that time, I was writing sort of fantastical short stories, art for art's sake kind of stories. And I got into my dream creative writing program in New York City in Columbia, and everything was working out great for me. But having worked in that clinic and being my father's daughter, I found that a life of writing just wasn't quite the right fit for me. I needed to have some work that felt more concrete. And ultimately, I left that writing program and decided to, you know, go to medical school.
And it wasn't straight to medical school because you had some classes or prerequisites to sort of fill in. So it was off to the other coast.
Yes. I really did not study science as an undergraduate. I was a writer. I was an artist. I was sure that that was, you know, the direction my life was taking and that those were the things that were going to be central to my life, and they had been central to my education. And so when I decided to go into medicine, I had to go back and study the real basics, biology 101, you know, physics, chemistry, organic chemistry. And it was fun. It was hard.
And Rachel, you decided to go to medical school at UTMB. That's the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. And a lot of the book is given over to your experiences there. One of the, I would say, defining features of your time there was Hurricane Ike. When did that occur? And tell us about, I guess, what damage it inflicted to the school and to the island.
Yeah, so Hurricane Ike happened while I was applying to medical school. As a matter of fact, my interview in Galveston was moved to Houston because of the damage from the hurricane. And Ike was not one of the deadliest natural disasters in American history, but it was one of the most expensive. And the reason for that was mostly because of the damage done to the University of Texas Medical Branch. The hospital was flooded. The facilities were really damaged. And so at the time that I was applying, they said, oh, you know, everything will be fixed by the time you're starting your clinical years, and you'll just be taking classes for the first 2 years anyway, so don't worry about it. And so I didn't worry about it too much. I knew that Galveston was a fit for me in lots of different ways, and not least because I could, you know, do a PhD in the medical humanities there. It's one of the only places in the country where you can do that. And so I said to myself, well, you know, this hurricane happened, but Galveston has been through hurricanes before. Galveston is resilient, and I had faith in the town to bounce back.
Tell us a little bit about the Institute for Humanities, and did you know going in you were going to do a PhD? Because that's pretty unusual in the sense that some medical students get PhDs, but usually in a hard science where they're going to work in a laboratory and be a sort of a clinical scientist or investigator. But an Institute for Humanities is pretty, in my view, pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place. I trained there at a time where there were philosophers, anthropologists, historians, literature scholars, and some of these scholars were also providers. But most of them were just straight up academics who did work that was looking at problems in medical practice and medical culture. And so I had the great privilege to study with these folks who had a really radically different perspective on medicine than I was getting in my medical school classes. So whereas in my med school classes, I could think about the basic sciences and I could think about clinical applications of science, at the Institute for the Medical Humanities, I could think about the social forces that form medical practice as we know it. And so it really opened my eyes in a lot of ways, gave me a lot to think about. And it was at the Institute that I was really challenged to try to come to terms with the history of racial bias in medicine and the ongoing problem of bias and of the use of communities of color for purposes of medical research and medical training.
And ultimately, some of the disparities and outcomes that we see, you know, all the time nowadays as well, because of these sort of historical frameworks that have been set up.
Absolutely. And confronting those at the time where I was really trying to form my medical identity and just trying to become a good doctor, to come face to face with that history that is honestly embarrassing as a physician and disturbing. I liked to think that medicine was objective, that medicine was different from the rest of society, that medicine was not colored by the same problems that color, for example, economic inequality or housing inequality. And so to confront those problems and to realize that, in fact, they're very much embedded in medicine, that was really hard. It was really emotional for me. I had a lot of that reaction where I said, hey, no, we're good people. We're not racist. But eventually I came to terms with the fact that that kind of scholarship and critique isn't about saying that doctors are racist. It's really about saying that the system that we work in has these structural problems that we cannot responsibly ignore.
So did for your PhD, was that what your thesis work was on?
Yeah, so I looked at the history of objectivity. And, you know, we think of objectivity as a fixed notion. But I looked at how objectivity functions in medicine and how physicians try to adopt this version of objectivity that really comes from science. So scientists have all these practices to eliminate the pernicious influence of the self from knowledge. So, for example, blinding and peer review and randomization, all those things are meant to wipe out the influence of the researcher's individual self and to produce data that isn't influenced by the self. And in medicine, I argue that we have tried to kind of adopt that same version of objectivity. But if we're going to really confront racial bias, we have to also confront ourselves.
That's really interesting. So the comparison then to scientific objectivity, how we have adopted that culturally into medicine, and yet probably in some ways you're arguing that's a mistake, that we need to confront our own selves and our own biases. That's very interesting, actually. I hadn't thought of it that way, because I've been, I think, raised probably like many doctors to see scientific objectivity and medical objectivity almost as one and the same. I think that's, would you agree with that? That in fact, that's how it's often presented?
Yeah, that's definitely how it was presented for me. And I had a conversation with one of my mentors where she described how when she went into the room with a patient, it was as if she wasn't there. She was just a sort of pool or a mirror for what the patient needed. And I think that attempt and that belief in erasing the physician's self from the medical encounter really comes from scientific objectivity. And it has its use. But if we want to get with the 21st century and try to address racial bias in medicine, we're going to have to come up with our own more useful version of objectivity that acknowledges that when a doctor comes into the room, she not only brings her biases, but she also brings, you know, how she's feeling that morning, whether she had an argument with her partner, what she had for breakfast. Like, we enter into medical encounters as humans, just like our patients do.
I want to hearken back to your discussion of UTMB and Hurricane Ike. So that was, as you pointed out, right when you were interviewing and you made the decision to go there under the promise that things would kind of resume as they had been. But when you actually got to medical school and into your clinical years, you found that really wasn't the case, that in fact there'd been sort of a sea change, I guess kind of a pun there, but a sea change in the direction, I guess you could say, of how UTMB decided to treat its poorer and uninsured or underinsured patients.
There certainly was. One of the things that drew me to UTMB was that it historically had been a charity hospital. So for about a century, it was the hospital in Texas that took care of absolutely everybody. And doctors across the state, and even some docs in Louisiana, if they had a patient they could not get care for, they knew they could send them to UTMB. And the state, you know, for its part, underwrote that care. UTMB was never expected to be a profit center. Everyone knew it was a charity hospital, and the state funded it as such. Now, in the years before Hurricane Ike, that began to change. Some of the state funding changed, and UTMB policies changed, where there began to be this effort to reduce the number of charity patients who were seen. And it was a gradual thing that was happening over the course of years. But then when Hurricane Ike struck, they very abruptly cut all charity patients from their roles. And I mean, they sent unfunded patients letters that said, due to the devastation caused by Hurricane Ike, Dr. So-and-so will no longer be able to see you. And that meant that even patients who were really sick and who were relying on care from UTMB physicians to get them through their day-to-day, including cancer patients, patients with renal failure, patients with lupus, patients, you know, sick folks who really needed care, suddenly found themselves without access to it.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Rachel Pearson. She is a resident in pediatrics in Seattle and the author of the brand new book called No Apparent Distress. It's her memoir, subtitled A Doctor's Coming of Age on the Front Lines of American Medicine. And she's recounting her time at UTMB. It's disturbing to think that the powers that be at the medical branch in Galveston sent letters to patients using Hurricane Ike, perhaps with some honesty, but perhaps with some underhandedness. Because what was happening, you recount how at least one of the physicians, very pointedly, letters were sent out under those physicians' names without their knowledge. And so this idea of abandonment, of abandoning patients while they're under a doctor's care, was very upsetting for the patients. And of course, you know, the doctors really didn't have a say in this matter.
Yeah, it was upsetting and life-threatening for the patients. And then for the doctors, many of them could not believe that this could happen because the notion of non-abandonment is so important to us. We stand by our patients, and it's part of our identity, I think, that we would not leave a patient of ours in dire straits when they needed us. We would make sure that even if we couldn't be there, that they would get care from somebody else. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the docs at UTMB found that, in fact, it was true. The institution can say this patient will no longer be cared for. And I can't claim to have a perfect knowledge of all the factors that went into it. You know, like, I know the state funding was part of it. I know local factors at UTMB were part of it. I know the debt that the university had gone into because of the evacuation from a prior hurricane was likely part of it. But the effect on patients' lives and on doctors' ability to do right by their patients was pretty horrific.
Along those lines, I want to ask you about the St. Vincent Clinic, which I think was a very formative experience for you in Galveston. St. Vincent Clinic is something that medical students typically, or some of the medical students at least, it sounds like, staffed and were a part of, and it was in sort of on one side of the island, and, mm-hmm. and it had a very unique population that it served. Can you tell us a little bit about St. Vincent and your experiences there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the St. Vincent Student-Run Free Clinic, it's a lovely place. It is in the historically African-American side of Galveston, and that side is defined by segregation and by geography. So the historically African-American neighborhoods are the neighborhoods that flood. And so when Hurricane Ike hit, it was those neighborhoods that were most affected and those folks who were most affected. But St. Vincent's was one of the first organizations to swing back into action and start taking care of people after the hurricane. The clinic is housed in a community center that has a food bank and a school where you can get your GED or you can take English as a second language classes and all kinds of community resources that are super important for those communities that are struggling a little bit more. And the clinic is actually one of the largest student-run free clinics in the country. So at the time I was there, We saw between 1,200 and 2,500 unique patients a year. For many of those patients, we were their only access to care. And we offered not only primary care, but also specialty care. So we had psychiatry night, gynecology night, dermatology, rheumatology. Lots of specialty physicians volunteered their time there to make sure that these patients who had no other access to care could get at least some of what they needed. And actually, since I've left, the free clinic has established a dental clinic. So now folks are able to get access to dental care, although I hear the waiting list is about 300 patients long.
So is St. Vincent, is it able to accommodate the folks that have, in a sense, been displaced by the hospital, or is it just simply would be overwhelmed if it were to try to accommodate all those folks?
At this point, I guess I should say, at this historical point, it fills a different role. A lot of the folks who were cut from the UTMB patient list have scattered across the state into other states. But at this point, St. Vincent's is serving unfunded patients from across Southeast Texas. So some people drive 2.5 hours to get there. And it's really important to understand that the clinic isn't perfect. So it can do what a good primary care clinic can do, but the waits are long. You will see students, you will see junior students. And if you are really sick and you need surgery or you need chemotherapy or you need a CT scan, those services just can't be provided by a free clinic. So one of the most heartbreaking things about working there was I often had patients who we could get up to that point where we had diagnosed them and we knew they had cancer, for example. They had very serious diseases, but we could not get them the treatment that they needed.
And you write poignantly about a patient you call Mr. Rose. What was his story?
He was a patient who I saw pretty early in my training. I was just finishing my first year, starting my second year of med school. And he was the first patient who I really, really connected with. And it was because he came every week. And the reason he came every week was because he was really sick. The first time he came in, I was just mind-boggled by his problems. He had fluid in his belly. He had pain. He had a weird taste in his mouth, and it felt like his food was getting stuck. And I did everything I could for him. I made some mistakes in his care that I know now are pretty understandable for a junior student, but they were serious mistakes. And we tried to get him. We knew he was really sick, but we couldn't figure out exactly what it was because we couldn't, sample the fluid in his belly. We couldn't do a CT scan. So we tried to get him in the hospital. We sent him to the ER. They didn't take him. And by the time he finally did get into the ER, his cancer had metastasized all over his body, including to his brain. So it was too late for cure to be an option for him.
I mean, that must have been so devastating. And you write very poignantly about how it, really helped you frame how you interact with folks and slow down to really listen and, I guess, try to think more. I mean, of course, as a junior student, you're just learning the process of how to do the interview and how to match dialogue or symptoms to, actual illnesses. So you were hard on yourself.
Yeah. No, when I think about it now, it seems crazy that I was in that situation at all that early in my training. But, at St. Vincent's, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about what folks go through when they don't have access to insurance. I learned a lot about basic pathology. I learned a lot about procedures. I learned a lot of medicine there. And after a long time, it came to bother me that I was benefiting so much from being there. I was learning so much, but my patients who, you know, from whom I was learning, were not able to get all the care that they needed. That just didn't seem fair and it didn't seem right.
You decided to go into pediatrics, which you're training in now. I guess what led you in that field and where do you see yourself going?
Yeah, so pediatrics felt like the right home for me because, you know, pediatrics is really fundamentally a social justice-oriented profession. Kids under five are the Americans most likely to live in poverty. And when I found that when I talked to pediatricians about social determinants of health and healthcare justice and, you know, how people need not just access to medical care, but safe neighborhoods and good schools in order to be healthy, the pediatricians were right there with me. You know, and obviously kids are great. So I decided to go to Seattle. I work at a really wonderful hospital there. I'm getting really good training, but I wanted to see a system that was different from what I was seeing in Texas. I wanted to see what it was like where my patients could get everything they needed, all the resources they needed, regardless of how much money their family made. So that when I go back to Texas, I will know what I should be demanding for my patients there.
So the plan is to go back to Texas and work on these issues of justice and equity in medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had hoped at this time to be having a conversation that was beyond just access to care. My hope was to be having a conversation that was about imagining a medical system that was more just to all groups, about how medicine could really come together and come up with policies to address racial injustice and to make justice a fundamental value in medical practice. Unfortunately, we find ourselves again in this situation where even basic access to care is threatened or unavailable for so many Americans. And that other project of imagining a subtler kind of justice, we're not ready for that when people are still dying in the streets, you know, or dying of treatable conditions.
The name of the book is No Apparent Distress. It's a doctor's coming of age on the front lines of American medicine. And it's written by my guest today, Dr. Rachel Pearson, who is a pediatric resident in Seattle. Thanks so much for joining us, Rachel.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Rachel Pearson is a pediatrician in Seattle and the author of the new book, No Apparent Distress, A Doctor's Coming of Age on the Front Lines of American Medicine. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.